a monk approached Kaoshan and said, "It's stifling hot today. Where could one go to escape this heat?" Kaoshan said, "In a pot of boiling water, in a hot coal in a raging furnace." The monk said, "How can one escape the heat there?" Kaoshan said, "Suffering does not reach it." The monk was silent. Dogen's commentary to this is, before you approach it, and this is from memory, it may not be verbatim accurate, but something to this effect, Dogen says, before you approach it, it is a thick forest of brambles, a 100-mile wall, cliff. When you understand, you see that from the very beginning, the thick forest of brambles has been nothing but the self. Nothing but the self. For peaceful abiding, mountains and waters are not necessary. Simply cut off the myriad streams of thought. Put out the mind fire. So a monk approached Kaoshan and said, "It's stifling hot today. How may one escape this heat?" Kaoshan says, "In a pot of boiling water, in a red-hot coal in a raging furnace, how can one escape the heat there? Suffering does not reach it. Before you approach this matter, it's like a thick forest of brambles, a 100-foot cliff. When you understand, you see that from the very beginning, the thick forest of brambles has been nothing but the self." It's not necessary to look for stifling heat. Life presents it. And it's more authentic, more real, more useful for practice to be ready to face the stifling heat when it occurs than to contrive difficulties. I was talking to a friend who she's a student at CSUMB, and she's taking a lot of yoga, and she's doing teacher training for yoga, and she talks about her stubbornness, that she doesn't like to smile during yoga. She's a very delightful, pleasant, jovial person, but she says, they're always smiling in these yoga classes. You know, it feels like, you know, they're mandating that you must smile, you must be blissful. And I find that pretty annoying, she says, and I find myself stubbornly refusing to smile. I said, well, yeah, that's probably, you know, you may be right, that may be the yoga persona. I said, you know, in Zen we have, you know, personae too. We like to be really present. You know, that's one of our great virtues. And so one of the Zen personas is sometimes, see how present I am with my eerie stare, you know. And so in Zen, when I first started practicing Zen, I heard a lot about getting in touch with your suffering. I found that pretty annoying. I came to listen to the creek. I came to enjoy birdsong. I hasten to say that it is perfectly fine to enjoy the sound of the creek. It is perfectly fine to enjoy the song of birds. There's this film of Suzuki Roshi in Tassajara saying that if we try to look for something wonderful, it means that we ignore the bird which is singing now. And if you think Buddha said something wonderful, I must find out what he meant. I must penetrate. Then your mind is directed towards Buddha's words and you don't hear the bird. So it's perfectly okay to appreciate the sweetness of life. However, if we're habitually turning away from the difficulties in life, we will be unable to have authentic, deep, no barrier connection to the sweetness of life. Our very aversion to difficulties is what prevents the bird song from entering into our heart. So we place a lot of emphasis on quote unquote getting in touch with your suffering. It's not a dour negative thing. Kaoshan says that in the boiling water, in the raging furnace, suffering does not reach it. What does that mean? My very first practice period at Tassajara, during Sesshin, Mel Weitzman said, talking about knee pain, and he said, funny thing is, or paradoxically, the only way to actually deal with the knee pain is to do the opposite of what we want to do. We want to run away from it. We want to avoid it. We want to escape it somehow. And there's no relief in that intention. But if we turn towards it and accept it, and do the opposite of what our gut impulses are screaming at us to do when the knee pain is screaming, we can actually sometimes find relief by that wholehearted turning towards. And he also said something that I found interesting. He says, if you wait until the knees start screaming, it's too late. The way you practice at the beginning, before the knees start to screaming, determines whether or not you'll be able to do this. So, like Hamlet says, readiness is all, From the very moment we sit down, are we prepared to be fully present to what is arising in its spontaneity? If we're just sitting, letting the myriad streams of thought run amok, and then when the scalding heat begins, we won't be able to enter the boiling water. The raging furnace. But there is relief in turning towards the difficulty. From the very beginning, it's nothing other than the self. From the very beginning, Suzuki Roshi says that for a Zen student, a weed is a treasure. When we pull the weeds, we bury it close to the plant to nourish the plant. He also says that it may appear like there's something outside of yourself that is bothering you, but it's only waves of your mind. Waves and water are one. Disturbing kleshas, disturbing mental happenings, and Buddha mind are one. From the very beginning, it has only been the self. There is relief turning towards what we want to turn away from. It goes against our basic instinct. It takes practice. But if it is true that nothing outside of us can really disturb us on some fundamental level, if that's true, even that car horn, and if we can actually turn towards what's going on and see that it's just the self, there can be relief. Night before yesterday, I was meeting with one of our guests, and I had a panel of people with me, our advocacy director and the team leader of the women's shelter. And we'd already concluded that what we needed to do was to tell her that she couldn't stay in the shelter. If she wanted to meet with us again in a week to reconsider, and if she were to attend at least 3 AA or NA meetings before next Thursday, we would be willing to reconsider and contemplate a way that she could start to receive services again. And so I knew this meeting was coming, and I did my very best to ground myself in preparation and hold the space in such a way that she wouldn't feel judged or stigmatized in the process of receiving this news. And it went, and it was an interesting dance, but it went pretty well. You know, the outcome actually, she softened to some extent. She said something like, "Well, Rick, if I make a real effort and I go to these meetings, would staff meet me halfway and not just always give me a hard time, and, you know, before I even open my mouth, I can feel that they're judging me?" And I've observed, you know, this particular guest is really, can be really obnoxious, especially when she's had too much crack. How much crack is too much crack? Anyway, she comes in, and I can feel myself, actually. We'll call her Sally. That's not her actual name. But when she comes into the shelter, I can feel the Rick's body of Sally start to come up. You know, kind of like, oh, gee, here she comes, you know. And then with awareness, I can, like, step outside of that body and not be determined by that body. And I see staff kind of like going for it. the body of Sally comes up, and they're reacting to Sally when she hasn't even done anything to merit a reaction. You know, so I told her, yeah, okay, and, you know, there's truth to what you're saying. And, you know, if you'll do this, I promise I'll talk to staff. I'll do my very best to help staff, you know, give you that space to try that you're asking for. So it went really well, and I was very pleased with myself. And I thought, well, I'm going to reward myself by stopping at CVS and buying myself some Klondike bars and have some ice cream tonight. So I got to CVS, and there was this woman fumbling with her purse and her stuff, and I'm getting a little impatient. I want to get in, get out with my ice cream, go home, and enjoy myself. I can feel I'm getting a little impatient. And then she pulls out a key, says, "Could I get a copy of this key, maybe?" And there's only one person on duty, and he has to walk halfway across the store to make a copy of the key and come back. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm feeling impatience and irritation rise fairly strongly. And then I remember the Lojong training, three objects, three poisons, three seeds of virtue. The three objects are pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. their interior subjective states in relationship to a so-called pleasant object or unpleasant object or neutral object. And the three poisons are greed, hate, and delusion. We like to call them in Zen center, aversion, attraction, confusion. And obviously the objects and the poisons have a relationship to one another. And the teaching of this slogan is, as Norman Fisher likes to translate it, turn things around. You know, that very moment of experiencing the object and the poison can be a moment of virtue. That can be turned around. How do you escape searing heat? In a pot of boiling water. In red hot coals of a raging furnace. So I remember that teaching of turn things around. And I somatically felt the irritation, kind of like this tightness right in here and a little constriction feeling in here. And I felt myself kind of slip more into the moment, and the colors of CVS has a lot of primary colors, you know, and they became a little bit more vivid, and I felt this suffering is just energy, just a kind of energy. And it wasn't suffering anymore. It was just this phenomenon that I wasn't running away from anymore, or I wasn't in denial of it anymore. It was just some energetic state. So how can you escape searing heat and boiling water and the raging coals of a furnace? Suffering does not reach it. When you realize that from the very beginning, the forest of brambles has been nothing but the self. And self is and always has been Buddha. Suffering cannot reach. Waves are the practice of water. If the ways of your mind are one with the water, where is the separation is gone. And if the separation is gone, suffering is gone. Not only does this kind of work, which is difficult work, not only does it allow us to have authentic relationship with the sound of the creek and the sound of birds and with one another, our willingness to do this work when the heat is searing helps us live more authentically throughout our lives, and not greedily, not with a materialistic bent, but with a chaste, humble, grateful sense. It's imperative that some of us find the means to do this work. Because, you know, you need to put out the mind fire, collectively. So I'd like to go to Auschwitz someday. I don't know if that's the right way to put it. I want to go to Auschwitz someday. When I was a younger man, I was in the military, and I was stationed in Augsburg. And Augsburg is a stone's throw from Dachau, another concentration camp in Germany. Actually, Auschwitz actually is in Poland, but Dachau is in Germany. And when I was there, I knew it was there. I knew Dachau was there. And I felt I should go. But I was afraid. I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to handle it. And so, you know, although I felt I should go, I also felt like I can't go because I don't have the inner resources to deal with it, so I didn't go. As you probably know, Bernie Glassman leads retreats in a boiling pot of water. And he leads retreats in the raging coals of a furnace. In other words, he leads retreats deliberately in Auschwitz. He feels that the depth of the horror of what happened there is proportionate to the possibilities for healing. And I watched a film about one of his earlier trips, and the interviewer, you know, asked him, you know, why Auschwitz? Why do you want to lead retreats at Auschwitz? And his response was, all humanity has to see that part of themselves, which they are trying to forget, which has led to the possibility of Holocaust and genocide. This is still going on. There's a part of us which will allow us to dehumanize people. There's a part of us that will allow us to dehumanize people. Anybody in this room ever dehumanize a person? Huh? Not too long ago, I was pumping gas, and this guy came up to panhandle, and I didn't look at him. And I said, I've been working with the homeless all week long. I'm in my bubble. I want to stay in my bubble. And here I am, allegedly devoting my life to serving the homeless, and in a very palpable way, I was unwilling to see the humanity of that person that was in that moment coming up to the panhandle. It's, you know, it's compared to other modalities of dehumanization, it might seem rather small, but what Bernie is saying here is there is a part of all of us which will allow us to dehumanize people and then to kill them. I feel that there is that part of us, and it is a part that we don't want to touch. And Auschwitz is a world monument to that aspect of ourselves. So I think that's a palpable example of following Kaohsiung's advice. Our collective mind is searing hot. How do we escape from it? Turn towards the fire. Acknowledge it. Touch it gently with compassion. Don't judge ourselves for that part of us that can dehumanize, that part of us that can get impatient or irritated. Acknowledge it as our shared humanity. And suffering won't reach. And we won't harm, perpetuate harm. We've got this thing called vow, right? You know, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. A lot of us are here because we feel that lofty, almost insane intention resonates with us somehow. It makes sense somehow. That kind of insanity seems to make a lot of sane sense to us somehow. We feel compelled to enter into it. Then what? How do we actually enacted. Well, it's very, very, there's, you know, searing heat is bound to come. We can turn towards our pain as fuel for the path. We can touch that part of ourselves that creates hell, and we can liberate beings from hell by touching that part and being present to that part. We can transform our heart, our mind, and our world with those very things that we would rather not have around in our experience. And if we develop the appetite to do that, then we will be fulfilling our vow. And there'll be a joy that's deep. In the midst of sorrow, there can be joy. So I'd like to, I brought this poem before Patty shared with me some news. And now that I've heard that news, I want to dedicate this poem to Patty. The title of the poem is called Kindness. It's by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness. You must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans, and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak it till your voice catches the thread of it. Catches the thread of all sorrows, and you see the size of the cloth. Then, it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow.
or a friend.
So the heart of Zen is not a dour thing. We talk a lot about getting in touch with your suffering. But because we want to unearth the jewel of bodhicitta, the heart of limitless love and compassion, if we avert from pain and suffering, we bring it on. If we turn towards it with tenderness, desiring to understand, desiring to liberate ourselves and others, then suffering cannot touch it. And there's a composure and a resolve and a peace that can withstand all the pain of this world. Embrace it and transform it into love. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. Three objects, three poisons, three seeds of virtue. Turn things around. It's worth the effort. What choice do we have? I'm done. How are you, Patty?
Sad. Yeah. My dog was killed yesterday. Sad.
Is it okay I dedicated that poem to you?
Yes.
I thought it might help. So, and I had planned to read it anyway. So. To think about.
I had seen once when I was quite a bit younger about Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And I dreamed I was older and going there with a group of people who had were going there to decide if actually anything had really happened there or not.
Hmm.
So we went in and we were walking through. And I came to a courtyard, and the courtyard was made of stone. And the stone was polished from people walking in circles.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much time there walking in circles, and that was the evidence. Mm-hmm. That was the evidence right there. And then later, I saw a documentary about Auschwitz, and I had never seen any picture of it. Well, it was exactly the same gates, it was exactly the same driveway. It was very eerie.
Yeah.
And this whole thing about, they call them the deniers.
Mm-hmm.
people who deny this, and I'm Armenian, and then there's also people who deny the Turkish genocide and all the genocides that are going on. Mm-hmm. And there's always this struggle with the deniers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's the deniers don't seem to go away. It's part of the, you know, it's one thing within ourselves, and then what is our responsibility in terms of others?
There's resistance to want to try to understand horror. That there's some comfort in dehumanizing or pretending it didn't happen. I think they're equivalent, you know. Like people would want to dehumanize perpetrators of mass killings, you know, and they're monsters, you know. Like the Clive Olden Harris, you know, who committed the acts at Columbine were monsters, they were human. So I think the impulse is the same, you know, either to dehumanize or to pretend that it didn't really happen. It's, you know, to disassociate and not acknowledge that this is, you know, like Bernie says, that there's a part in all of us that could do this. And I know this. I know this. You know, and I've shared it with many of you before, I think, that, you know, when I was a teenager, I was ostracized and bullied, and I suppressed a lot of rage. And in young adulthood, flashing in my brain without any desire would be an image of taking a pump-action shotgun and firing into a crowd of people. You know, and that would flash into my mind unbidden, and I'd feel shame and try to suppress it as quickly as I can to, you know, and not dwell on it. And then, you know, that was in the 70s, and things like Columbine just didn't happen. But when it did happen, I had a feeling that on some level I understood. You know, that, you know, that, you know, the collective causes and conditions produced that event. It's difficult to see these horrific things as part of each one of us, or, you know, our human possibility, you know, that it could be us. So denying it happened or dehumanizing the perpetrators of horror, you know, keeps our image of who we are intact. And creates the karmic space for it to happen again and again and again. So that's why, you know, this work's important.
Do you distinguish between pain and suffering?
I don't know, the terms, you know, terminology can catch us. Mm-hmm. What I would say to that is that at CVS, kind of, it was a similar experience to what I've had in the Zendo, where I'll be sitting, and, you know, my knees are starting to ache a little bit right now. But it's not bothering me. There's this, you know, this stimulus that is, has an intensity to it. And in sitting in Sashin in Tassajara, there were times where I'd be sitting and struggling with the pain and not liking it and trying to turn towards it instead of away from it and all of that. And then all of a sudden, something would happen and there would be this fascinating, intense energy. And the intensity would be there, but it wouldn't trouble me at all. And that's what happened at CVS with the impatience and irritation. Mm-hmm. The somatic thing was still going on. The tightness in the jaw and the constricted feeling around the chest up here. But the narrative dropped away and I felt energized. I felt, you know, like the colors in the room seemed more vivid for a moment. And so I don't know if the dichotomy between suffering and pain really fits. It's like, you know, going from suffering to energy. And even pain doesn't, in those particular instances, even the word pain doesn't quite, because it doesn't feel painful. It feels, you know, energetic. It feels like there's an intense event happening that, so that's been my experience and how I would describe it. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with the resistance to what's going on. That seems to determine whether it's painful or whether it's suffering. It's, you know, this is happening and I really don't want it to be happening.
I've heard a distinction made, that's why I asked.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
You can't avoid pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's going to.
Yeah.
Come no matter what.
Yeah.
But you can do something about suffering. You can do, because the suffering is more or less the self, the interpretation of it.
Yeah. And depending on how you unpack the terms, you know, that could be exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. But I also had that experience you had, I think in my very first session, it was just intense knee pain. And then I just gave up, basically, and all of a sudden I was floating. It was astonishing. Yeah. And I wrote about it because I was so astonished by it.
Yeah, there's two themes in your talk that seem to are clashing in me. One is the idea that there's this place that suffering or pain does not touch. Mm-hmm. And the other is that sorrow, deeply understanding sorrow, is what brings compassion and kindness. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that what makes me kind is the realization that pain does not end. That makes me kinder than this idea that there's a place that pain and suffering does not touch.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather be kind than pain-free.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I personally feel like I could use.
Yeah. And I think that's the essence of the koan. The monk is coming to Kaoshan and says, you know, this heat sucks, how do I get away from it? And he says, well, jump into a pot of boiling water.
Yeah, I'm not getting that, though. I like the poem better, is what I'm saying.
But I think they're saying the same thing. I think the koan
is... I'm not getting that. I'm not getting that.
Yeah. You know, embracing the sorrow. Embracing the inevitability of the difficulty.
Okay.
And that... Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, Please Call Me By My True Names, he says... He talks about, you know, all of his cries and laughter, so you can see that his cries and laughter are one. So that the door of my heart be open, the door of compassion. So I'm misquoting it. I'm trying to reconstruct it from memory. But the reason why koans are so powerful and the reason why this poem has its impact is it speaks to a paradox. That grief fully embraced, when, you know, the grief of loss fully embraced, there's a kind of a, there's a love there, and there's a joy in loving, and the grief is still grief. And there's a willingness and a wholehearted embracing of it, because not to grieve would be to lose the love. In the case of a loss of, you know, someone loved. You know, if you're unwilling to grieve, you lose the love of that person. The only way to keep them in your life and the love of them in your life is to feel the pain of grief. And there's in, and so the grief and the joy and the sorrow are one. And when Kaoshan says, you want to escape the heat, well, go where it's hot. I think he's saying the same thing.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, there's a difference between escaping the heat and somehow having to be transformed to bodhicitta. Those are different things. It feels like different things, you know. Of course, maybe my mind is dividing in a way it shouldn't. But,
we'll see what Kaoshan is saying. It doesn't make any sense, right? Escape the heat by going into the furnace.
Yeah.
So he's implying that you can't really escape, I think.
Okay, I can buy that.
Yeah. Because logically it doesn't make any sense, and on purpose.
Yeah. I don't know. In my first sessions and sittings, I had a lot of body pain, and after years it went away, and I thought, smart, you know, hey, this stuff works. You can go into the pain, and then and the pain goes away. Now I'm getting older, and all the pain's coming back again.
Yeah.
Great.
So
yeah.
I actually like what's happening to me now better.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's important. You bring up something important. I don't know. Is that that experience of the pain of sitting with knees disappearing is not so important.
Yeah.
You know. If there are no pressing issues, we could close and sit more.
Wisdom, Maharajna.